Okay, I will call this. I'm going to call this testing. I don't know if it's working. Testing.
Of course.
He's got lots of thinking.
Testing. Huh. Sound check. 1, 2, 1, 2. Yours seems to be working a little bit better than. Testing. Testing. Not really mine.
Quiet.
Testing. If I get close to it, I'm touching it. My mouth is touching the thing now. We'll go with that. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is 10:04 a.m. on Monday, May 8th, 2023. Present today, we've got Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Representative Edgman, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Ortiz, myself, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Colomb. Before we start, just a reminder, if folks can mute their cell phones. Can everyone kind of not really? That's what I thought.
Really hear you.
Yeah. Maybe if you could call somebody over. I'm just going to speak up for now. And maybe I should do that. I'll do that.
Switching around.
Testing. Okay. This morning we will review modeling for two bills from Representative Stapp, and that's House Joint Resolution 2, Constitutional Amendment on Appropriation Limits, and House Bill 38. Relating to appropriation limits. So one is the statutory and one is the constitutional. We also have with us Representative Kronk. And we have asked for the Legislative Finance Division to put together the modeling that had previously been discussed relating to both of the bills. So we'll look at modeling at this meeting, take questions from members, and then set the bills aside. Just a reminder, we did set a amendment deadline for the two bills of, I believe it was this Wednesday at 5 p.m. Before I forget, we do have a request on Representative Josephson's letterhead, looks like from a couple of the members here in finance, just asking if we can extend the amendment deadline for HB 50, the carbon storage bill. To extend that, I believe the amendment deadline was this Wednesday, and just a request to extend it to this Thursday, May 11th at 5 p.m., which is sounds good. So we'll go ahead and extend to this Thursday at 5 p.m. So with that, going back to the spending limit bills, I'd like to ask Alexei Painter, Legislative Finance Analyst, to come to the table and put yourself on the record and begin. Mr. Painter will walk through and take questions regarding modeling, then Representative Stapp and Mr. Aoto can answer questions related to the bill specifically after the presentation. We've got question Representative Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, just I'm asking, could you reprise, because you, before you started talking about the House Bill 50 deadline, you said two other bills, and I needed to affirm which two bills was the Wednesday at 5? HJR 2 and SB or HB 38, the two we're hearing today?
Correct, yes. Those the two bills we're hearing today, that amendment deadline was is set for this Wednesday at 5 p.m., and I'm getting a positive head nod. So let's see here. Sorry, Representative Johnson, we're having technical difficulties with my, so I stole your mic for now, but if you'd like to steal it back, let me know. So with that, Mr. Painter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexei Painter, Legislative Finance Division. And I believe Mr. Carpenter is online as well, who put together some of these models, if there's questions specific to that.
Okay.
So before we get into the modeling of the HB 38 and HJR 2, I just have a few slides with background on the current limits and the exclusions. I know this was presented to the committee last week by the bill sponsors, so I'm going to go through this pretty quickly, but mostly just if you have any questions, this is your time to ask, so to ask me anyway. So this first slide here, slide two, shows the entirety of the constitutional appropriation limit. The next few slides are going to kind of break down and walk through that in a little bit more depth. So with an appropriation limit, there's sort of two parts. There's what appropriations are subject to the limit, and then what is the limit. So we'll start with what appropriations are subject to the current limit, and I have some highlighting here that will correspond to the graph on the next page. So it sets out some exceptions to the limit. And one thing I'll note before I start is that the exceptions are both fund sources that are not subject to the limit, and then there are also certain purposes of for appropriations that are not subject to the limit. So you can't look at the limit and say, well, all general fund appropriations are subject to the limit, or all appropriations except for these purposes. There's kind of exclusions on both sides, and that can make it a little harder to necessarily see what exactly is subject to it. So the first exclusion is permanent fund dividends in yellow here, so that is not included in the current limit. The next is appropriations of revenue bond proceeds, appropriations required to pay the principal and interest on general obligation bonds. So essentially, that is excluding any sort of bond debt repayment from the limit. And then appropriations of money received from a non-state source and trust for a specific purpose, including revenues of a public enterprise or public corporation of the state that issues revenue bonds. And so this limitation includes federal funds. Those are held in trust for a specific purpose, statutory designated program receipts where an outside group initiates a contract with the state. That doesn't fall under the spending limit because of that. Revenues of a public enterprise or public corporation, so that's Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and so forth, those are outside the limit. And then no appropriation in excess of the limit can be made except to meet a state of disaster declared by the governor. So again, there's an exception would be to meet a disaster. So then there's a few other things in here that are not highlighted on the slide, but the legislature can also exceed the limit for appropriations to the permanent fund. So when we've done special appropriations of general funds to the permanent fund, that falls outside the limit. And then there's been attorney general's opinions over the years that talk about, you know, how certain expenditures fall in and out. One, for example, says that school debt reimbursement is out of the limit because it falls under that debt provision, although it is not a state general obligation bond, it's a municipal general obligation bond. The attorney general in 1983 said that that counts as well, so that's excluded from the limit. So as we're looking at, as Ledge Finance and the Division of Finance that does the official calculation looks at the limit, we're looking at both the exclusions of fund sources and then certain types of expenditures that are excluded from the limit. Going on to slide four, this is the appropriation subject to the current constitutional limit in FY23 management plan. That's the current budget. So you can see in purple, these are the appropriations actually subject to the limit, about $5.8 billion. Dividends, including the energy relief, for about $2.1 billion. Bond proceeds, pretty small. And then the appropriations of money from a non-state source, that's actually the majority of our appropriations because of nearly half of our appropriations are federal. And then when you add in the public corporations international airports and so forth, that actually ends up being over half of our appropriations fall into that category. So when we look at the appropriation limit, it's not all appropriations, just this category in purple that are subject to the current limit. Okay, so then the other factor in a limit is what is the limit set to? So we have, you know, what does it apply to, and then what is it set to? So the current constitutional limit applies to $2.5 billion as adjusted by the cumulative change derived from federal indices in population and inflation since 1981. So $2.5 billion growing with population and inflation. Now, there's a little ambiguity there about how to calculate it. The Division of Finance in the Department of Administration that does the official calculation, they multiply those two things together. So if you have a 2% growth in inflation and population, you take the limit and multiply it by 1.02 twice. On the other hand, the municipality of Anchorage has a tax cap that has this identical wording and actually spells out the formula and does it differently than that. They add the two numbers together. So if you had 2%, 3%, you'd, you'd add 2 plus 3% to get a 5% growth. That sounds like a minor difference, the add or subtract, but actually when you compound that over, you know, 40 years, that's about a $3 billion difference in the limit between those two. So it's ambiguous. The official calculation is what I'll show, but just for a note, when you're trying to design a limit, we really encourage you to try to make it very clear how it is calculated, because in this case, the current constitutional limit is not clear. And we would view that as kind of ambiguous language, but again, the official calculation is multiplying the two multipliers together. So that official calculation gets to a limit of $11.3 billion in FY23, our current fiscal year.
Question, Representative Galvin?
Thank you. Just for clarity, you mentioned that the municipality of Anchorage does it differently, and there is approximately a $3 billion difference. May I ask in which direction? So we're looking at $11.3 billion, and I presume that it would be either more or less than the $11.3 by $3 billion difference?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the other calculation would be about $3 billion lower.
Lower, so it would be at $8.3
billion. I know it's 8-point-something billion.
Okay.
.3, but yeah, it's a few. It's in the $8 to $9 billion range versus the $11 to $12 billion range.
Thank you.
Okay. This next slide shows the since the inception of the limit, the appropriations and the bars, and then the line shows that constitutional limit, the official calculation. So the blue bar is agency operations. That tends to be our steadiest item. Green is statewide operations, and then red is the capital budget. So in the first few years, we actually, our current numbers show that we broke the limit. That's because at the time, a lot of language appropriations were not counted in the way that we today would count them. So we would say, using our modern counting, that we probably broke it in the first 3 years. In the contemporary accounting, they said that they came within it. So we did not think at the time that we broke the appropriation limit. Then we had a prolonged period of budgets that did not grow very quickly, did not keep up with the pace of inflation, and that caused there to be a pretty big difference between the appropriation limit and the budget. When we had a lot more revenue, expenditures spiked and actually approached the limit in a few years but did not reach it. Today, when we again have more constrained revenue, appropriations are, you know, a bit more than $5 billion under the amount of the limit, of the constitutional limit.
Sure. Representative Edgman?
So this slide right here is obviously not new. I've seen this in many iterations before, and likely we'll see it again in the future. But one thing I've always felt that's missing on this slide is the population growth in the state, because so much of our operating budget is population-driven. Medicaid, for example, and so on and so forth. And that's, you know, the current proposal that we have before us doesn't have a direct link to population, which I think it should. Our population is getting older, getting more senior citizen sort of oriented in some respects in terms of delivery of services and programs. But could you maybe take a second and comment on the impact of population and overall state spending?
Co-Chair Edgman, yes. So population and inflation are the two things that this adjusts for. Population will influence the amount of students in schools, the amount of recipients of Medicaid. A lot of our largest budget drivers are driven by the state's population, but not just the number, also the composition. You know, the aging population means fewer students in schools. And in fact, we've seen roughly the same number of students in our public schools for about 25 years, despite increasing population over that time. But you see more people utilizing social services as the population ages. So that population has grown, but then also shifts where the expenditures, you know, what areas in the budget those occur in. It doesn't necessarily mean there's lower expenditures because there's an aging population. In some cases, some departments are a lot higher. One interesting way to look at this graph would almost be to adjust for inflation and population and show this black line is flat, and then show how expenditures have fluctuated in real terms rather than showing how the line has fluctuated, because, you know, it may look like, well, we've increased the budget substantially, but obviously inflation and population, which the limit is designed to account for, have increased far more than our budget have. as depicted on this graph.
Follow?
Yeah, and we, our state services, Alaska is unique in comparison to other states because we pay for more state services than virtually any other state in the country. We really do. That's the way our constitution is framed. So we don't have just, you know, cascading layer of taxes at the county level. Of course, we don't have counties. So to me, I think population has to be a driver in any spending cap. It just simply has to going forward. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Painter, I am wondering if in the 07-08 era, did we change the definition of statewide operations, or can you help me understand why we had that, you know, a large jump in reflection of that, and then that seems to be fairly steady proportionally?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that was really driven by two things. One was the statewide assistance retirement, so we did not have an unfunded liability that we knew about until FY03. And so that became an item that, you know, was $700 million a year by FY13. That did not exist as a statewide item before. And then another is oil and gas tax credits. There were a couple of bills in the 2000s that created the purchasable tax credits that are no longer in the books, but we still are paying them off. That was an expenditure that was several hundred million dollars a year at its peak as well. So those two items account for most of that increase in statewide items, is really those two particular things. The other thing you see a little bit of is that during that time, there was some creation of new state funds, such as the Higher Education Fund and increasing the PCE fund and so forth. And those show up when we create a fund, often as a statewide item. Although if it requires a further appropriation, it would be outside the limit. So wouldn't necessarily show up here, those particular ones. But I think those two particular items account for the vast majority of the growth in statewide items.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. through the chair to Director Painter, so I just kind of wanted to maybe take a crack at Representative Co-Chair Edgman's kind of earlier question. So to me, I can't think of any example in which basically population growth didn't positively affect gross domestic product output. The two kind of metrics are pretty correlated. Of course, the same is true of population decline, right? I mean, is that a fair assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Staff, to some extent, although in Alaska, because our economy is driven by resource extraction, you know, our GDP fluctuations in part are due to the prices and quantity of resources that are being extracted. So the oil industry, timber, fisheries, the mining industry, you can actually sort of look at those statistics. And if you take out the minerals, for example, that includes oil and gas, it's much more stable and reflective of overall economic growth. But those fluctuations in value of our exports really drives a lot of those year-to-year fluctuations. And those are not directly tied to population, although we have seen when oil prices crashed, there was less activity on the North Slope and population did decrease in the state. So there is definitely a relationship, but it's not as direct as in many other states because of the large value of our natural resources.
Thanks.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Benjamin.
Yeah, continue the very friendly volley that we're having here. The way I look at it is a little bit differently, too, because 70% of the population resides in the rail belt in the state. So the GDP overall, does that, you know, whatever that number might be, and it's an academic term that can fluctuate given, you know, one-time events or this or that that may have no impact at all on the cost of living in the outlying 30% of the state, which lives off the road system, and the cost of living, which to me, population being directly involved in the spending cap has a better tie-in to that cost of living or, you know, the actual you know, ability for a state to provide those equal amount of services in Manicotic or in Nelson Lagoon or Queetluck or wherever that they might be able to provide in Anchorage or the center part of the state because of GDP numbers that are very different. They impact the state in different areas. So, you know, I'm interested to hear more discussion on it, but to me, a GDP calculation is it's in the abstract in a lot of respects, and it doesn't quite reflect the actual costs of providing services out in outlying areas.
Representative Gavin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I just want to make sure that I'm appropriately reading this. So the black line now is saying through the if we were to follow the constitutional appropriation limit, that would be where we would be. Is that correct? That would be the line.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, if we spent to the limit every year, yes.
If we spent to the limit, and clearly we haven't. And we know that in 21, 22, we had substantial inflationary costs. And yet we're not seeing any rise in appropriations there. And I guess to my point around all of this discussion is that we haven't kept up with our costs. And I guess regardless of population size, we still have to deliver certain public services, whether we have three people who need that bus or 33 who need the bus. We have to take the bus. And we know that the price of oil and certainly the price of diesel has gone up substantially. And so to me, what I'm seeing is kind of an explanation as to why we're pretty frustrated that our schools, for example, and other public services that we've been providing have been flatlined, and that we're frustrated to see we don't have enough money to spend on wages and certainly not healthcare benefits and things like that. And yet, that's because I presume the money just hasn't been there. This does not include anything related to our PFD, though. Is that correct on this?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes. The permanent fund dividend is not included as an expenditure subject to the limit, so it's not included in this graph.
Okay. So I guess my question would be, if we were to include the PFD, and maybe this is something we're not allowed to discuss, I'm not sure, but it seems like if it's one of our largest spends, and we're talking about a spending cap, it seems like it needs to be part of our equation, Chair. So I'm not sure if I'm out of line here to ask that question.
Everything is on the table.
Okay. So I wondered if you would comment a little bit on the pieces that I brought up, and that is the 21-22 inflationary costs going sky high, yet we're not seeing any increase here. I mean, to me, what it says is either we've had no money to deliver services, or we've decided to make sure that the PFD is large enough. And that's my question to you. What would it look like if we included PFD on this discussion?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we have a few slides in the later on in
coming
this
up,
showing
okay.
the PFD, not with the current limit, but with the proposal in the bills in front of the committee. One thing I would say is there was a substantial increase in spending in FY23, but there had been a drop in FY22 because spending has largely followed available revenue more than, you know, attempting to approach the line in any way.
Okay. Co-Chair, if I may follow up on that one, would some of that be related to federal funds that were COVID pass-through funds, or is this all state funding that we're looking at?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, all federal funds are excluded from this because they're held in trust for a particular purpose. The one exception is when we used ARPA revenue replacement that spends as UGF, so that is shows just the same as UGF. But yeah, federal funds are not included here.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
All right, I'm going on to slide 7. So another item in our current constitutional limit is how it treats the capital budget. So the limit says, within this limit, at least one-third shall be reserved for capital projects and loan appropriations. So sometimes people say, well, this means that, you know, one-third of our budget should be capital, two-thirds should be operating. That's not really how that reads. It reads as, again, within the limit, at least one-third shall be reserved for capital projects. So if we go back here, that means that of this line of $11.3 billion, one-third of that should maybe for capital, and only two-thirds of that may be for operating, meaning that essentially there's kind of a separate limit for the operating budget that's two-thirds of the overall limit. Then the capital budget can be any amount, but they're reserving up to a third. So it's not saying that every year our budget has to be you know, two-thirds, one-third. It's really just setting a lower limit for the operating budget. Then there's some provisions that essentially are saying that we can actually exceed the limit for appropriations for capital projects if we pass them in a similar manner to a general obligation bond bill, because since general obligation debt is excluded, essentially the limit says, well, if you have the money now, you could actually just send it to the voters and approve it and exceed the limit for that. So there's not any bias towards debt, essentially. It's not hugely important today when we're so far beneath the limit. Okay.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Painter, did you run any, if we were looking at the graph, did you do any comparisons to see if there were any years where we did two-thirds operation, one-third capital budget? If you did, what years were those?
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, we've never had a budget that has one-third of the budget going to capital during the time this limit has occurred. There are a couple of years, I believe FY14, for example, where the operating budget exceeded the two-thirds. So if you're interpreting the limit, you know, and looking at the constitutional limit and saying, well, the operating budget can only be two-thirds of the total limit, there were a couple of years that the operating budget did exceed that two-thirds. In the early years of the limit, there was an attorney general opinion that dealt with that that said essentially, well, if we have constrained revenue, then we can't necessarily keep the operating budget, you know, we don't necessarily want to put that to the capital budget. I don't know that, say, FY08 would qualify as constrained revenue, and that would be a year that we show as violating the two-thirds. So we've done versions of that show that two-thirds, and you can see where we've broken that a couple of times.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the Chair, follow up on that. So you, Mr. Painter, is it your assertion that a lawsuit could have been viable in those 2 years, had one been filed?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, I think by a plain reading of the constitutional limit and the appropriations of those years, we likely did violate the two-thirds. Nobody challenged it at the time. The timing of the constitutional appropriation limit also sort of makes it so if you were challenging it, you'd have to do it after the fiscal year is closed and those expenditures have been made, which is a bit of a challenge to figure out what the consequences would be if a lawsuit is filed. And I think that's something that, you know, the current bills and others try to address by making it so you can calculate the limit ahead of time so you actually know if you're breaking it. The previous or the current constitutional limit, you really don't know it ahead of time. So it's just after the fact, somebody could have come back and challenged what we had done. But at the time, I'm not sure that there was awareness that we were in danger of breaking that two-thirds.
Please continue.
All right, going on to this current statutory appropriation limit. So it was established a few years after the constitutional appropriation limit. And it is based on appropriations made in a fiscal year rather than for a fiscal year. So what that means is instead of saying, well, all appropriations made for FY24 count, instead we would be saying all appropriations we're making this year in the legislature were in FY23 is how you count the limit. So the question is why? Why would you do that? And really the answer, you could look at last session as a great example of why the current statutory appropriation limit exists and how it would work if it were followed. So the current statutory limit limits spending growth to inflation plus population plus 5%. That seems very high. So last year we had 8% inflation, 5% inflation, zero-ish population, so 13% growth. But last year we had a very big spike in revenue, far more than 13%, and the legislature, in fact, grew spending by 56% of UGF, although I think if you look at what applies to the limit, it's a smaller growth, but still well in excess of 13%. So the current statutory limit would essentially say, well, you can't spend all of that revenue spike. You can only spend up to that 13%, 8% inflation plus 5% in addition of that spike. So it's not designed to be like a path you follow, and I think our graphs are maybe misleading on this front because we show it as a path, but really it's a year-to-year, hey, legislature, you can only spend up to X percent more than you did last year, regardless of how big of a spike in revenue you have. And so this limit has been broken repeatedly since it's in statute. We can do that. Our constitutional power of appropriation trumps that. But again, that's sort of the intention of it. So if you're the reason it's for a fiscal year or in a fiscal year is because it's saying in a session, you can move things freely across supplementals and non-supplementals. In fact, last year, there were a number of capital projects that had a supplemental effective date because that's when revenue was available, but they didn't really apply particularly to that year. That was just where revenue is available. So the current statutory limit lumps that all together and essentially is session to session. So if you look at the graph of that in slide 9, you can see that we've broken it quite often, quite a lot last year. And again, this is in FY22, so last session, the session laws 22, applying to both FY22 and FY23 appropriations made last session. We violated the statutory limit by quite a bit. We violated it by a little bit less, kind of every other year for a little bit, FY18 and 20, and then quite a few years as we were growing the budget through FY12. So, you know, again, this is the current statute. We've broken it a lot, but the intention is just to lop off those spikes when we have a spike in revenue.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Painter, you know, one of the areas where we frequently spend big in supplemental is wildfires after the fact. And, of course, in one good policy model, it's let's put more money into their operation up front so that we're not always backfilling them. Within the current statutory appropriation limit, what would make the most sense of how – I mean, should we exclude wildfire and supplemental because of its unpredictability from the calculation, or policy-wise, would it make more sense to exclude it completely or,
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, so that would fall under the state of disaster, but interestingly, it's a bit of a place where the way the limits work doesn't really give you the best incentives because the governor generally only declares the disaster when he needs money beyond what we appropriated. So if we decided, hey, we're going to appropriate zero, and then, you know, everything would be a state of disaster, wouldn't count. Or we could appropriate a larger amount up front, you wouldn't have a state of disaster, and then, you know, it wouldn't qualify. Under the statutory one where you're growing from year to year, that's perhaps not as big of a concern as long as you have a relatively stable budget, and then any disaster spending beyond that would just not get counted. That doesn't perhaps give you issues. But if you were looking at a constitutional model that, you know, has this fixed point, for example, you could perhaps game that by zeroing it out. It's relatively small in the, you know, I mean, it's a lot of money. It's hundreds of millions, but in the scale of a $6 billion subject to the limit, for example, it's not a huge lever, but it is perhaps an area where maybe it's a little questionable as currently written, and perhaps there could be clarification in there to ensure the legislature doesn't have an incentive to underfund wildfire to get under the limit.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
All right, so now we'll move on to House Bill 38 and HJR 2. So it uses these bills use similar appropriations included and excluded as the current limits. It sets the limit as a percentage of private sector GDP for both constitutional and statutory limits. So the current CS is 11% of private sector GDP in House Bill 38, and then 13% for the constitutional limit in HJR 2. Each percentage in the limit equals about $475 million of spending. So if you're looking at comparing these numbers, that's essentially the sensitivity. Is if you want to go from 11 to 12, that'll increase the amount under the limit by $475 million. For future years, that amount will vary as GDP is assumed to grow. So we were asked to have a few graphs. So just to start off, here's a graph I'll orient you to of just the current CS, which I think Mr. Aalto presented last week. So this shows the current CS of House Bill 38 and HJR 2. The bars here are the appropriations subject to the limit. The blue line here, or the area in the background is revenue. The blue line is the proposed statutory limit. The red line is the proposed constitutional limit. And the black line is the current constitutional limit. And you can see the FY24s here, and then it has projections going forward from there. So again, this is showing it with 11% and 13%, which is the current CS, which you saw last week. The next few slides will show different versions of the bill, and then also putting the PFD on that, which was the other request the committee made last week.
A question.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Painter, is it realistic? I see the growth in GDP that's projected there. If we're putting downward pressure, which is the background blue, on operating budgets, which I would assert contribute to GDP, and I think sort of it's inarguable that they do, is it believable or realistic that sort of growth that's identified by Ledge Finance would happen?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, projecting GDP is very difficult. We do not have an official Alaska GDP estimate, like there is, or projection. There's, you know, Department of Labor and any other institution does not have a responsibility to make a projection. We're sort of making up this 1.5% number. It's based on historical averages. We don't have a very good idea because there's no official projection. So I don't feel comfortable speculating about what influences it because, again, that's not something that's currently a projection that's made in the state. So 1.5 is really just an arbitrary number we put in there.
But through the chair, but if, for example, we had population growth toward, well, the beginning of the next decade, we needed new teachers, but we couldn't hire them. And so those teachers we couldn't hire couldn't buy homes. That would impact GDP, wouldn't it?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes. I mean, any fiscal policy choice you make is going to influence GDP, for sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Okay, the next version of this graph shows the HB 38 and HJR2 as they were originally introduced by the sponsor. So that had 11.5% for the statutory and then 14% for the constitutional. That half a percent difference is about $237 million. That 1% difference in the constitutional is, again, the $475 that we talked about before. So with those currently, or as the original version, you can see that in FY24, it's a little bit closer in the statutory to the current budget as proposed by the House. This is the House version of the budget we're showing, than the previous limit that was substantially under the House budget. Seeing no questions going.
Oh. Representative Godwin.
Thank you. My question is more related to the various, and maybe you can help me with this, but it's operating versus capital and how we've been behaving as a state historically. It feels like the lines have been pretty muddy. In other words, I see a lot of things in operating budget that I could imagine being called capital and capital budget being called operating. And so I just wondered if you could share a bit more about that. And if we were to have HB 38 and HJR2 in place, would that make for more jockeying around, if you will, in order to just make things add up in the right place?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So there are legal definitions for the difference between operating and capital. Generally, when appropriation bills are drafted, we're a little more strict about trying to put operating budget items in the capital budget because the capital budget has a longer lapse time frame. So You get some advantage by putting an item in the capital budget. So the operating budget, we're a little less strict on putting capital items in the operating budget because if you only have a year to spend it, that's kind of a disadvantage to have it in operating instead of capital. So there is some muddying because the legislature, again, retains the power of appropriation. You can put things in whatever bill you want and call it whatever you want despite the opinions of Ledge Finance and Ledge Legal. Where we often, you know, we'll give guidance on where which budget we think things belong in. But, you know, because there's no particular, I don't think there'd be any difference in how operating and capital are treated in this. I'm not sure there'd be any incentive to try to muddy the waters. under the current limit, for example, yes, there is an exclusion for capital projects, but only if you get the vote of the voters to approve them, which is a pretty high bar that our normal capital budget does not go under. I'm not sure if that's retained in HJR2 or not. I don't have that bill in front of me.
Thank you. Quick follow-up, if you may. So you mentioned that there is, to some degree, a bit of muddying that's happening currently, but that's based on what we as legislators have chosen to do. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, are we setting ourselves with putting in these parameters, are we adding more clarity and more transparency, or are we putting in opportunities to try to get into the right equation that might have less transparency then?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I'm not sure that this bill would necessarily change the legislature would choose to call a capital and operating item. Mm-hmm. Generally, I think the legislature tries to follow the statute that sets out what qualifies as a capital project and what qualifies for those capital lapse provisions that are more favorable.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Painter, because of generous IJA funding, for example, would last year's budget have required a two-third vote from both chambers to exceed the cap on capital budgets?
Through the chair, Representative Justin. So last year's bill, the federal appropriations themselves are outside the limit, but match would be included. Last year in FY23, the operating budget alone exceeded the limit contemplated under the original version. So it would have certainly required an additional vote to approve last year's budget.
Follow? Given that members of both chambers, including minority members, and frequently minority members, would be aware of that fact, could they not leverage their vote in exchange for yet additional capital dollars, having the effect of growing the capital budget?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, I think that's kind of similar to the dynamic with the Constitutional Budget Reserve, where, you know, again, people can use it for leverage, and often that leverage is additional spending rather than reduced spending. And any higher vote threshold could be leveraged for more spending. If that's possible, for sure.
Follow up?
And even though that may sound like cronyism or crass politics, it has a rationality to it as well. I mean, you may not want to comment on that, but human behavior suggests that that sort of thing could happen. Is that fair?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think we're getting into more political territory than I necessarily
Thank you.
Please continue.
All right. The next slide here, slide 13, shows the should be SJR4, so I was putting this together pretty quickly, showing the Senate version of the bill. Those were amended upwards to 12% for SB 20 and then 15% of GDP for SJR4. And those numbers were selected because they're pretty much in line with the current budget in FY24. I think they were selected because they're almost exactly in line with the governor's budget. I think we're showing, compared to the House budget, it'd be just slightly different, but again, very, very close to the current budget. And that's the version in the other body right now. And that should say SJR4. I will correct that slide. Okay, the next item we were asked to present is to show add dividends on here. So this is showing in purple, adding the statutory dividend, then we'll show the 50% that was in the House budget and then the 25% that's in the current Senate budget. So this is showing with the statutory dividend, just adding that on. Again, that's excluded from the limit today as currently drafted in the CS and in the current constitutional statutory limit, but we were asked to show that so you can see how that compares to the appropriations under the limit.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Painter, let me affirm, I believe you said at the beginning, but because the PFD is excluded from the current constitutional limit, you have not included it in our operating monies. So in the years where you've put the statutory PFD, but the bars showing operation expenses do not include the PFD that we did pay, even in the years when we did not include a statutory. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hammond. So, yeah, these historical numbers are just what we had paid, and then the statutory is the projection going forward. So for FY23 and before, this is the PFD that actually went out, not what the statute was that year, and then the projections 24 and beyond are showing the statutory amount.
Chair Foster, did I hear you say, Mr. Painter, so in those years where we did not pay a full statutory, it is still showing in here in purple, even in those years where it's not showing?
Through the chair, Representative Hinton, it's showing the amount we actually paid for all years,
okay,
whether we follow the statute or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
All right. The next slide here shows PFD at 50% of the percent of market value draw. That's the amount that was included in the House budget. Again, layering that on going forward, the historical ones are what was actually paid each year.
Okay. Please continue.
Your bells, we only have one more slide. So this is showing, the same thing, but with the 75-25 PFD, 25% of the POMV draw going to the permanent fund dividend, as contemplated in the other body's budget currently. And again, that's just the amount going forward.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr.
Coach, Representative Benjamin?
I think it's pretty obvious, but to have a spending cap in place as contemplated here with the bills in front of us, something would have to give, whether it's the PFD, whether it's spending on the operating or the capital budget side, something is going to have to give in order to meet that spending cap threshold or triggering a sort of a supermajority vote. Am I missing something there?
Chair Edgman, as the bill is currently in front of you, yes, that would be. It's significantly below the budget that the House currently has drafted. So if you were going to that number, the 11%, you would need to either reduce the budget to meet that number, or you would need to change that number in the bill, which is how the other body approached it in their CS.
And I think, Mr. Kocher, just to round things out, that would also speak to the 11.5% and 14% of GDP as modeled earlier, and the 12 and 15% as well. So everything that's been modeled sort of presumes that in order to have a spending cap as envisioned or proposed in front of us, something's going to have to give down the road. I mean, whether it be on the budget side or the PFD side.
Through the chair, Rep. Edgman, yeah, that would be, so since the PFD is not included in this limit, at the 12 or 15, that number would be close to our expected spending, assuming spending is fairly flat going forward. But if you're doing one of the lower numbers, it would certainly require spending reductions.
And if I might close out, Mr. Chair, that's why these bills give me a pause, because right now the way they're written up, it's going to be on the central services side, capital operating budget. I think we really need to take a hard look at that.
Okay. Representative Stapp, did you have a...
Oh, just a quick one, if you would, Coach Foster, through the chair. Just, Alexi, for the record, on the current side, the 12 and 15, that spend underneath the proposed statutory limit at those percentages, that actually includes the capital budget as well. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp? Yes.
Thanks.
We do have to go to the floor. Mr. Painter, I think... Well, it'd be nice. Are you available if we were to recess and then just come back at 1? We're scheduled to come back at 1:30, but if we came back at 1 just to give us another half hour to give opportunities to address questions to Representative Stapp, are you available?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I'm available. And again, I'm out of slides, but I'm happy to be here to answer any additional questions.
Okay. Maybe we'll head down to the floor, we'll adjourn, and then if we could plan to come back at noon for questions for the sponsor of the bills. So... I'm sorry, 1 o'clock, thank you. So with that, When we do come back at 1:30, we will have introductory hearings on House Bill 122, which is the profession of pharmacy, as well as House Bill 21, school and university employee health insurance. You know, I think those are just introductory, and they shouldn't take too long. So we can probably just come back at 1:30 or recess this meeting, reconvene at 1:30, and then once we're done with this, then we can start our other meeting. So we'll just start at the regularly scheduled 1:30 meeting. So with that, we'll be adjourned at 10:54 a.m. Thank you.